judgment.
Okay, she said. You realize, don't you, that you weren't saying what I thought? You were saying what you thought. I was just listening. Okay, she said again. Clearly, they couldn't kiss or hug. He looked at her with trepidation and concern, said, "Take care of yourself," and patted her shoulder. She watched him retreat down the block, and when he reached the crosswalk, she re-entered the lobby of the Four Seasons, found a bathroom, shut herself in a stall, and bawled. 20 days had passed since she and Graham had had lunch, and Julie was, when by herself, still crying frequently. This was why, on the morning of chaperoning the field trip to the Butterfly Center, Julie told Lucas's teacher that she needed to pick up a prescription and, instead of riding the bus, would meet them there. Because Julie stopped crying when she passed Dunlavy Street, she had enough time to recover and look mostly normal before joining the students, teachers, and other parents, which, of course, meant other mothers. In the last 3 weeks, Julie and Graham had had no contact. Though she'd seen him from a distance at the girls' basketball tournament, they hadn't spoken. The sight of him across the high school gym had made her realize that in the short term, she would miss him as the person she'd lain awake in the middle of the night imagining being naked with. But in the long term, what she'd miss was their conversations. At the Natural Science Museum, Julie parked on the north side. Like the majority of women she knew, she drove an SUV, hers a black BMW. She pulled off her sunglasses before peering at her face in the mirror on the sun visor. Her eyes were only marginally more bloodshot than usual, and her lips, which sometimes swelled when she cried, were their regular size. She put her sunglasses back on and climbed from the car. The school buses had discharged their freight, and when she joined the throng on the plaza in front of the museum, the second graders were leaping around and jostling one another. Lucas, along with his best friend Drew, was climbing on a railing on the steps. She waved, and Lucas, who was the most easygoing of her children, waved back. He didn't feel the need to either publicly cling to or ignore her. Many times, with other adults, Julie had winkingly referred to Lucas as her oops baby because of the age gap between him and his sisters, but she didn't anticipate using the term with its subtexts of sloppy, spontaneous marital passion ever again. Julie found Mrs. Ackerberg, who was Lucas's teacher. "Here's your group." Mrs. Ackerberg handed Julie a piece of paper with a typed list of names on it and added, "I've paired you with Gail Nelson." Julie hoped her sunglasses concealed her dismay. She hadn't known that Graham's wife, or ex-wife, depending on what stage of the divorce proceedings they were in, would be here. Gail definitely hadn't been part of the group emails Mrs. Ackerberg had sent. Aloud, Julie said, "Great!" then looked around to locate Gail. Sure enough, she was standing near her daughter, Macy. Julie pretended she hadn't seen her and approached Lucas. "Hey, Squirt," she said, and he said, "Hi, Mom." Lucas was 4 feet tall, with blonde curls. "We were out of cheddar, so I put Swiss on your sandwich for lunch today," she said, "just so you're not surprised." "Okay," Lucas said. "And there's chips," Julie said. "And an apple." Lucas looked at her with benign curiosity, and Julie thought that this might be her lowest moment yet. Worse than all her lustful daydreams about a man other than her husband, worse than her recent months of preoccupation, worse even than unsuccessfully throwing herself at Graham.
"Darth Vader is stronger than Sidious and Obi-Wan put together," Lucas's friend Drew said. "And he survived in the river of lava."
A whistle blew, and the children lined up. Mrs. Ackerberg and the two other second-grade teachers took turns reading names aloud so the kids knew where to stand. Gail appeared next to Julie and murmured,
"There's something I want to ask you."
Julie tried to sound neutral as she said, "Sure." She had no idea whether Gail had ever suspected anything. It was possible she hadn't, and also possible that Gail had suspected before Julie herself did. But Julie doubted that Graham had told her about their lunch.
"This spring is Mrs. Ackerberg's 25th anniversary at the school," Gail said. "Paula and Jen and I were thinking all the families in the class should go in on a gift certificate. But do you think she'd rather have one to a restaurant or a spa?"
"Oh," Julie said. "Well, you could split the difference, right? And do both? I'm happy to contribute."
"If it were me, I'd prefer the spa. I think Sanctuary is really nice."
It was like cortisol, or something, had been released into Julie's bloodstream in preparation for a showdown, and though the cortisol had proved unnecessary, she was compelled to deploy it. She said, "Gail, how are you doing? In terms of, you know, Graham?" Even now, there was a certain illicit thrill in saying his name aloud, as if he were a regular person. Gail rolled her eyes.
"Have you heard that he's moved in with Beth?
He was staying at a residential hotel for a while, but now he's at her place.
Frankly, I'm not sure what she sees in him. What does a gorgeous 30-year-old woman want with a man having a midlife crisis?"
Julie's heartbeat had picked up. "Who's Beth?"
"Beth Brenner," Gail said, "in Mergers and Acquisitions."
Julie had a dim idea of who this was, an employee of the firm where both Graham and Keith worked, an up-and-comer who was, if Julie was thinking of the right person, her own physical opposite. Her mental image of Beth Brenner was of a tall, slender blonde wearing a short-skirted business suit and high heels.
"I'm sorry," Julie said, which of course was true.
Gail shook her head.
"He claims it started after we separated, but come on. You know what, though? She can have him."
Because the children and adults were entering the museum in a horde, it wasn't the moment for Julie to burst into tears again, though there was time to discreetly check her phone and confirm that Beth Brenner was who she was picturing. Half the second graders were led to the Butterfly Center proper, basically a tropical greenhouse, and the other half, including Lucas's group, started in a classroom, where they were each given a sheet of orange paper that read, across the top, "The world has many butterflies." Below that were the words, "Did you know?" and an assortment of facts. Butterflies have four wings, fold them when resting, and live during their pupal stage in a chrysalis. A docent led a discussion among the children while Julie and the other adults stood against a side wall. She can have him. Would Julie ever in a casual conversation say that about her husband and another woman? It felt unlikely. She had wondered, in retrospect, if she had been hoping to leave Keith for Graham, hoping she and Graham would marry. She thought, but wasn't certain, that she'd only been trying to have an affair. Though how embarrassing, in light of the news about Beth Brenner, that Julie had imagined Graham might desire her 44-year-old self, even boob-lifted and hair-straightened. Sometimes, in the last few weeks, she had thought maybe he'd been denying his attraction to her as an act of chivalry, in order not to destroy her marriage, too. But Beth Brenner offered rather convincing evidence that he'd said he was never romantically interested in her because he was never romantically interested in her. The children made butterflies out of paper, glitter, and pipe cleaners, and Lucas tried to give her his to hold as they left the classroom. Julie shook her head.
"You can hang on to it like everyone else," she said.
In front of the doors to the rainforest, Julie, Gale, and the 10 children in their group were told by another docent that they should not touch the butterflies, even if one landed on them. Before exiting, they'd need to make sure no butterflies were clinging to their clothes. Already, Julie could feel the humid air. Julie had been to the Butterfly Center several times. Inside its tropical clime, a walkway snaked around massive nectar plants and fruit trees below a 3-story roof of window panes. At first, the children shouted out on glimpsing a butterfly. Someone identified a zebra butterfly, then a green swallowtail. But they were so plentiful that the children soon settled down. And yet, Julie thought, the world did not have many butterflies. Or at least for her, it hadn't. A long time ago, after Julie and Keith had been dating for a month, they'd gone for drinks one night with a bunch of his business school classmates. And the next morning, while the two of them were still in bed at Keith's apartment, Julie had begun describing her impressions of his friends. That guy James had been a blowhard, and Ross had made a weird comment about affirmative action, and clearly Nick's girlfriend was anorexic or bulimic or both. In fact, Julie wondered if she'd puked in the bathroom at the bar, because she'd been gone 20 minutes and returned to the table wobbly and minty-smelling. From his side of the bed, Keith had said, without looking at her, "It's not that you're wrong, but when you say stuff like this, it makes life a lot less enjoyable." Julie had felt chastened, which possibly had been his intent, or possibly that was only a byproduct, and the intent was simply to get her to stop. That she had stopped, and remorsefully rather than petulantly, she'd interpreted as a sign of her own maturity, the maturity of their relationship. That Keith had wanted her to stop, she'd interpreted as a sign of his decency. She was just a few feet from the exit when the butterfly landed on her forearm, on top of the thin sleeve of her white cotton sweater. The butterfly had wings of mostly iridescent blue, edged in black with tiny yellow flecks. She raised her arm the way she would if another person were about to hook his through hers. She expected this to make the butterfly depart, but it remained in place.
"Mom," said Lucas, "there's a butterfly on your arm. You guys, there's a butterfly on my mom's arm."
The second graders were ecstatic. They exclaimed to her and one another as they approached, inspecting the insect, and still it didn't move. It quivered a little, but it didn't fly away. Gale, who was also nearby, said, "That's good luck, Julie. You should go buy a lottery ticket." If there was a kind of person who believed in the magic of butterflies, Julie was not one of them. She had no use for this small moment of ostensible enchantment.
"Or maybe it's that you get to make a wish," Gale said.
It was rude to stare, Julie knew, but for many seconds, she stared at Gale anyway, wondering just what it was the other woman imagined she would wish for.
Vox Clementis in Deserto. I'd seen Ray Sullivan around campus, but it wasn't until early February of our freshman year that I decided I wanted to be like her. This realization happened at Dartmouth's post office on a Tuesday morning when I was in line behind her. I was there to buy stamps and she was sending a package. It was a little after 9 a.m., a quiet hour, and as the only person working helped the students in front of us, I had plenty of time to scrutinize the package in Ray's arms, a cardboard box addressed to a person named Noah Bishop. Though the rest of Noah Bishop's address was obscured by the angle at which Ray was holding the box, I could see that her handwriting was jagged in a cool way. It was unfeminine,
and she'd decorated the borders of the box with patterns reminiscent of an Indian tapestry, and the rest of it with erratic hearts drawn in black and maroon Sharpie. The hearts seemed to me unabashedly feminine. Also, of course, they implied that Ray, whose name I hadn't known until reading the return address in the box's corner, was sending the package to her boyfriend for Valentine's Day. At that time, the thing I most wished for was a boyfriend. I'd been aiming, unsuccessfully, for a Dartmouth boyfriend, but it seemed even more romantic to have one somewhere else. It implied yearning and passionate reunions. I was 19 and a virgin, and hadn't so much as kissed anyone since arriving on campus 5 months before. Ray was a little taller than I was, wearing corduroy pants, Birkenstock clogs, and a North Face coat that, when she turned after paying, fell open in such a way that it revealed a gray hooded sweatshirt with the word Exeter across it in maroon. I couldn't actually see all the letters of Exeter, but I'd been at Dartmouth long enough to recognize the name of a fancy boarding school, even if I was from Des Moines. Over her wavy brown hair, Ray wore a black skullcap. If you went feature by feature, I don't think anyone would have said she and I particularly resembled each other, but there was something recognizable about her to me, some similarity. Our builds were about the same, our hair the same length, our clothes comparable in their implication of not exactly making an effort, though this was 1994, when almost everyone was making less of an effort. But Ray's way of not making an effort fashion-wise was, like her handwriting, far cooler than mine. Mine stemmed more from confusion than indifference, and resulted in a wardrobe of unironic, colorful sweaters and bleached jeans that were loose but tapered. I didn't speak to Ray in the post office, but that night, after I took off my sweater, it was a cotton crew neck with alternating squares of turquoise, orange, and black, I never put it back on. I resolved that in the future, I'd wear only solids. In the fall term of the following year, Ray and I ended up in the same English seminar. I knew from having looked her up in the freshman book, a forest green paperback booklet filled with black and white headshots with full names and home addresses listed underneath, that she was my year and was from Manchester, New Hampshire. When all of us in the seminar went around the room and introduced ourselves, she said she was an English major. I was pre-med, referred to at Dartmouth as pre-health. Although things still weren't great for me socially, I liked my classes, both the sciences and the humanities, and my grades were good. Partly because I'd been a diligent student in high school and my work habits were ingrained, and partly because I didn't know what else to do with myself. I studied a lot. As a freshman, I'd been assigned a single, which was unusual but not unheard of. For me, it had been disastrous. In the new setting of college, I didn't know how to integrate myself with other people. I had spent a tremendous amount of high school, even while I was studying, thinking about how badly I wanted to go to Dartmouth and about the boyfriends I'd have there. I hadn't realized how much time I'd devoted to my imaginary, longed-for life at Dartmouth until I arrived at Dartmouth and found that by achieving my goal, I had lost my primary means of entertaining myself and feeling optimistic. My father, who was a rheumatologist, had himself graduated from Dartmouth in the early 70s, and my family had driven from Iowa to attend his 10th reunion when I was 8, whereupon I had developed a decade-long fixation with the school that was almost romantic in its intensity. When I started college, my father had been the one to accompany me to campus. This time we flew, changing planes in Chicago, and prior to classes, I'd attended a freshman orientation camping trip in the White Mountains. The night after the trip ended, several girls on my hall assembled by the stairwell to walk to a fraternity party. It was a minor triumph that I'd managed to attach myself to this group. As we descended the steps, the girl in front, a very pretty blonde tennis player from Washington, D.C., named Annabelle, called over her shoulder, I heard they call this the GFU party. She paused, then added merrily, short for get fucked up. There were 8 or 9 girls in the group, and I was bringing up the rear. When I froze, I'm sure no one noticed. I stood there while they descended another flight, and then I returned to my room and lay on my bed and listened to a Garth Brooks CD. My father and I had attended 2 of his concerts together, and eventually pulled out the MCAT study guide I sometimes looked at before bed. It was a 500-page, 8x11 paperback, and something about it was very comforting to me. The girls did, apparently, notice my absence eventually, because the next day one of them said, "Where did you go last night? We were all wondering." I said I'd felt sick, which, in a way, I had. For my entire freshman year, I didn't set foot in a fraternity house or, for that matter, a sorority house. Over the summer, in Des Moines, I spent mornings babysitting for a family with 2 little boys and afternoons volunteering at the hospital where my father worked. On my bedside table, I kept a list of concrete things I could do to improve my life at Dartmouth, which included, once a week, if someone seems nice and approachable, ask if they want to go out for pizza at EBA's. At least say hi to, but try to also smile at people I pass. Join the debate team. Back on campus, I lived in a single again, and as I pulled sheets over the twin mattress for the first time, I wondered, but not optimistically, if this was the bed where I'd lose my virginity. As it happened, I didn't join the debate team, and I didn't execute my EBA's pizza initiative because, after the very first English seminar, I was leaving the classroom in Sanborn House when a female voice behind me said, "What a douchebag!" There was a boy walking not with, but parallel to me, about 5 feet away, and we made confused eye contact, unsure if the comment was addressed to either or both of us. When I looked over my shoulder, I saw that the speaker was Ray Sullivan. In a disgruntled but chummy tone, as if we'd previously had many similar conversations, she added, "I heard he was full of himself, but his arrogance exceeded my wildest expectations." She was referring, I assumed, to the seminar instructor. Although it was a literature class, he had started by telling us he was a poet and spent 15 minutes describing his work. He'd called it language poetry, a term I had never heard. But I hadn't been bothered by the personal digression. I'd found it impressive. "I read one of his poems, and it's literally about having anal sex with his wife," Ray was saying. "And I've seen her, and she's a total cow." I said, "I'm taking the class to fulfill the English requirement." This was as close as I could get to disparaging a professor. The boy, who had introduced himself in class as Isaac, said, "I found the poems in his first book derivative of Ashbery." Ray looked between Isaac and me, intensely, for a few seconds, as if making a decision, then said, "Do you guys want to go smoke a joint?" After Ray and Isaac and I became best friends, it occurred to me only occasionally to wonder whom we were replacing. Who had been Ray's previous best friends? I somehow knew that her freshman roommate had been a girl named Sally Alexander, but she and Sally didn't seem to hang out anymore. Much like my freshman year neighbor Annabelle, she of the GFU party, Sally was blonde and very pretty. On the Dartmouth campus, there was a disproportionate number of blonde and very pretty girls, socially adept girls, sometimes gracefully anorexic or anorexic-ish girls. I'd observed several who ate no fat, ever. For breakfast, they had a bagel. For lunch, a bagel and salad without dressing. And for dinner, a bagel, salad without dressing, and frozen yogurt. Not that I witnessed it, but they apparently drank a lot of beer. As a freshman, I had found the term boot and rally so anthropologically interesting that I'd shared it with my parents, thereby disturbing my mother. I had a strong sense that among these poised, preppy, winsomely eating-disordered girls, I couldn't compete for male attention. Faced with the enticements of such creatures, what boy would want my dowdy Iowan virginity? Like me, Ray avoided fraternity parties, which at Dartmouth in 1994 meant avoiding parties. Unexpectedly, she too had a single. Hers was in Allen House, and in the evening after dinner, she liked to sit on her bed, roll and smoke a joint, and watch a VHS tape of Edward Scissorhands on her TV. I'd usually leave just before the part of the movie when the housewife tried to seduce Edward, because it stressed me out on behalf of both Edward and the housewife. We were often joined by Isaac, who had grown up in Atlanta and whom I intuitively understood to be gay and closeted. He was short, slim, black-haired, and excellent at participating in long, analytical discussions of Ray's two favorite topics, which were her relationship with her boyfriend and people on the Dartmouth campus she hated. In retrospect, I realize that I learned a lot from Isaac about the art of conversation, asking specific follow-up questions, offering non-sycophantic compliments. Sycophantic never seemed sincere. And showing patience in the face of repetitive subject matter. Unlike me, Isaac did share Ray's joints. I'd tried a few times, felt like possibly I was smoking wrong, and definitely I was reaping no clear benefit, worried about the short and long-term impacts on my memory, and declined from that point on, which neither of them seemed to mind. One surprising discovery I made in the first week of my friendship with Ray was that her boyfriend, Noah Bishop, recipient of the Valentine's Day care package, was younger than she was. He was a junior at Exeter, which meant that she had begun dating him when she was a boarding school senior and he was a freshman. Although Ray revealed this fact without fanfare or embarrassment, I found it so jarring that that night, when Isaac and I left her room at the same time, I said outside her dorm, "Do you think it's weird that she's 3 years older than Noah?" "Obviously, the norms of high school imply yes," Isaac said. "But it wouldn't be weird if their genders were reversed. And it wouldn't be that weird if they were a married couple, and she was 53 and he was 50. I took this in as we walked. Isaac was so much more articulate than I was that I might have found him intimidating, if not for the fact that he was nice. Though he'd make damning observations about people, he seemed to be simply stating facts rather than relishing their weaknesses. I said, "Did you go to public or private school?"
"Public."
"Me too," I said. "And I picture boarding schools being very, like..." I couldn't find the word.
"Conformist?"
he asked. "Yeah, which would have made them going out even weirder." We kept walking. It was getting dark, and I felt the particular longing of an Ivy League campus at dusk and wished I were walking with a boyfriend of my own instead of with Isaac. And I added, "Although Noah is really cute." Indeed, in photographs Ray had shown us, Noah was almost unbearably handsome, in exactly the way I wanted him to be, curly brown hair and full lips and a tiny silver hoop in his left ear. Apparently, his family lived in a huge house in Marblehead, Massachusetts. His parents disliked Ray, and he played ice hockey and the guitar. And he had lost his virginity to Ray, though she had lost hers to the son of a friend of her mom's. If I was offering Isaac an opportunity to formally reveal his gayness, he declined it. He laughed and said, "I bet Noah himself agrees with you." As the weeks passed, Ray became increasingly concerned that Noah was hooking up with a girl in his class whose name I secretly loved, Clementine Merriweather. In mid-October, Ray decided to pay Noah a visit, which would entail taking the hour-and-a-half bus ride from Hanover to Manchester, then borrowing her mother's car to make the 40-minute drive to Exeter. She invited both Isaac and me to go with her and stay at her mother's house for the weekend. Isaac said he couldn't, but I accepted. The night before we left, Ray had cramps and asked if I'd pick up dinner for her. As I was leaving the dining hall, carrying a tray with two plates of steaming lasagna and two goblets of vanilla pudding, I pushed open the door to the outside with my back, and when I turned around, I was face to face with Ray's freshman roommate, Sally Alexander. Sally, who was accompanied by another girl, glanced at the tray and said, in a voice that was more friendly than snotty, though the sentiment seemed snotty, "You're hungry." "It's not just for me," I said. "It's for Ray, too." Sally's eyes narrowed. "Are you friends with her?" "Yeah," I said, and though I felt a swelling of pride, it was short-lived. "You don't find her annoying?" Sally said. Taken aback, I simply said, "No." Sally shrugged. "She's so self-centered, but I think it's because she's an only child." Ray's mother's boyfriend picked us up at the bus station in Manchester after Ray had placed three calls to her mother on a payphone, and he was 50 minutes late and seemed irritated by our arrival. At her mother's house, which was one story, very small, and brown-shingled, he let us off without coming in, then drove on to the office building where he apparently worked nights on the janitorial staff. Ray's mother was a private duty nurse and wasn't yet finished with her shift. When she did come home, a little after six, wearing pale pink scrubs, she hugged Ray, then hugged me too, and said how beautiful my eyes were. I'm brown-eyed, and this was a compliment I had never received. She added that she could tell I was an old soul, then asked where I was from and how I liked Dartmouth. She had a thick New Hampshire accent, and both she and the house smelled like cigarette smoke, though the house was generally clean and tidy. We were in Ray's mother's presence for no more than 10 minutes before Ray asked her for the car keys. With an expression of good-natured disappointment, Ray's mother said, "She can't stay away from that boy, can she?" She made me miss my own parents, and it occurred to me to stay there while Ray went to see Noah. I was hungry, and I envisioned eating, say, chicken pot pie with Ray's mother, then perhaps watching Family Matters or Unsolved Mysteries together before going to bed at 10 p.m. But this would be a redux of GFU night, which had set me back God only knew how many months. Thus, reluctantly, I joined Ray in her mother's Honda Civic. The car was a standard, and I could feel how my earlier self would have been impressed by Ray's casual ability to drive it, seeing her possession of a skill I lacked as in keeping with her general aura of coolness. But there was more and more evidence, starting with the discovery that she was dating someone younger, then reinforced by Sally's comments outside the dining hall, that I'd invented my original idea of Ray, that really, the only person who perceived Ray as cool at all was me. And she hadn't pretended. I had misconstrued. I also, of course, hadn't understood until seeing her mother's house that Ray didn't come from a rich family. Her boarding school degree and her New Englandishly hippie clothes had confused me, because I was easily confused. I realized that, presumably, by Ray's standards, if not by my own, I came from a rich family. After all, I had taken out no college loans and was receiving no financial assistance. The decor of my parents' house in Des Moines wasn't that different from the decor of Ray's mother's house. Wall-to-wall carpet, faded sofas and chairs, shiny walnut tables. But my parents' house was much bigger. Ray slipped a cassette into the dashboard tape deck before backing out of the driveway, and the Indigo Girls' song, Joking, erupted into the car. When it ended, she said, Can you rewind it?
At her request, I did this so many times as we drove east on 101 that I soon knew precisely how long to hold down the button in order to get back to the song's start. Joking was on an album I'd heard in Ray's room, and though I wasn't certain what made this song a personal anthem for her, it started with intense guitar strumming, I understood the impulse behind it. The craving. We'd been driving for 20 minutes when Ray slapped her right hand against the steering wheel and said, "Fuck!" I glanced across the front seat.
"I forgot the pot," Ray said, "and Noah reminded me like 3 times.
I did not feel optimistic about Ray's reunion with Noah or about my own ability to comfort her if the reunion was unsuccessful. "Do you want to turn back?" She thought for a few seconds, then said,
"There's not time. He has choir practice at 8.
Hot, pot-smoking Noah Bishop was in the choir? I had been intrigued by the prospect of visiting an elite boarding school, but I couldn't see much as we arrived under darkness at what seemed to be the backside of a vast concrete gym. A boy in a down vest, a plaid flannel shirt, khaki pants, and sneakers was standing with his back to the gym, under a light, and Ray unrolled her window and wolf whistled at him.
"Do you have it?"
he asked.
"Fuck you," she said out the window. "That's not how you greet me."
She parked in an otherwise empty lot, and we both climbed from the car. Gratifyingly, Noah Bishop was even handsomer than he looked in photographs. She approached him, placed both hands on his shoulders, and kissed him on the mouth. When she pulled away, she said, "That's how you greet me." He gestured toward me.
"Who's that?"
"My friend Dana," Ray said.
Noah nodded once and said,
"Yo, my friend Dana."
I knew that when Noah ejaculated, he made a whimpering noise like a baby. That when Ray gave him hand jobs, he liked her to use Jergens lotion. That the first woman he'd ever masturbated to had been Kelly LeBrock after he saw the movie Weird Science. And that his father had been investigated by the SEC and found innocent of wrongdoing, though Noah himself suspected that his father was guilty. I also knew that sometimes Ray knelt on the floor of her Dartmouth dorm room, clasped her hands together, and addressing the phone on her desk, said, "Call me, Noah. Just please fucking call me right now."
"Hi," I said.
"Did you get the key?"
Ray asked Noah, and he said,
"Yeah. Did you get the weed?"
"There were complications," she said.
I cleared my throat.
"Is town that way? Maybe I'll go eat dinner. I should be back by, what, 8, Ray? Or 8:15?
"Sure," she said, and I could tell she was barely paying attention. Even though I made a couple of wrong turns, I reached the town of Exeter within 15 minutes and kept walking until I found a place where I could buy a meatball sub and a Diet Coke. A handful of kids who looked like students came in, and I reminded myself that the unease I felt about eating alone at Dartmouth was irrelevant here. When I finished, I walked along Water Street, not entirely sure what to do. I had no idea, of course, that of all the feelings of my youth that would pass, it was this one, of an abundance of time so great as to routinely be unfillable, that would vanish with the least ceremony. The stores, most of which were closed, were brick, with awnings or quaint wooden signs outside. I entered a pharmacy. When I found myself in the family planning aisle, I decided, just as an experiment, to buy a pack of condoms. Would I plausibly seem to the cashier like a person who was having sex? The wide array, lubricated and ribbed and ultra-thin, bewildered me, so I went with what was cheapest. I also picked up a bag of Twizzlers and some lip balm.
for camouflage. My heart was beating quickly as I waited to pay, but when it was my turn, the cashier seemed as uninterested in me as Noah had. By then, it was almost 8, so I walked back to the gym swinging the plastic bag with my purchases in it. At first, I thought my timing was perfect, because as I approached the gym, Ray was pulling the Honda out of its parking space. Then I realized she was pulling out alarmingly quickly. Her tires squealed in a way I had rarely heard in real life. When the front of the car was pointed toward the road, she revved the gas and almost ran me over as she sped past. "Ray!" I yelled. "Ray!" But the car didn't stop, and its taillights had soon disappeared.
"I guess you're screwed,"
someone said, and I turned and saw that Noah stood about 20 feet away, smirking. I walked toward him. "Where's she going?" He shrugged. "Is she coming back?"
"Hard to say."
"Did she say she was going to find me?" He shook his head.
"Sorry."
"Did you guys have a fight?" This was a nosier question than I'd have asked under normal circumstances, especially of a good-looking guy, but he was still in high school. Plus, Ray was, or had been, his girlfriend, and she wasn't prettier than I was. And then I understood, with a weird, revelatory kind of internal kick, what had drawn me to Ray in the post office. Since arriving at Dartmouth, I'd felt my own lack of prettiness as a humming, low-level failure. I wasn't singularly unattractive. My existence wasn't a crime. But I also wasn't, in an environment of youth and affluence, fulfilling my part of the social contract. The thing it mattered the most if I was, I wasn't. And yet, Ray wasn't really fulfilling it either. Ray wasn't beautiful or blonde or thin or charming, and she didn't seem apologetic. Even having lost some of my original respect for her, I still envied her confidence. Noah said, "She's pissed because I didn't want to fuck her." I blinked, then said, "Why not?" Did I think there was useful information to be gleaned here? Sexual or romantic lessons? Or was I already scheming? Looking back, I'm still not sure. Shrugging again, he said,
"She's on the rag."
He grinned as he added,
"I told her she could still blow me."
I hesitated, and my heart abruptly began to pound at double or triple time. But I spoke slowly. I said, "I'm not on the rag." Although this wasn't a locution I generally used, there was much about the moment that was out of character. If I'd been hoping that some transporting lust would seize both of us, I would have been disappointed. The expression on Noah's face was a surprised and faintly amused sort of curiosity, as if he was wondering if I'd farted. He raised his eyebrows and said,
"Yeah?"
We were, at that point, only about 4 feet apart. "Yeah," I said. I didn't know what to do next, and I thought of turning and sprinting away. But I again recalled the GFU night, my failure of nerve. Presumably, I needed to touch him, but how? The 2 times in Des Moines when I'd kissed boys, they'd both initiated it. The most logical place to make contact with Noah seemed to be the crotch of his pants, but that was too aggressive even for the person I was pretending to be. And kissing him seemed logistically complicated. He was well over 6 feet, significantly taller than I was, and I wondered how Ray had made it look easy. From somewhere far away, I heard bells ringing, the 8 o'clock bells, followed by the distant, cheerful-sounding, intermittent shouts and cries of teenagers. Instead of having sex with me, was Noah about to depart for choir practice? With both my arms, I reached for his right hand, brought it to my chest, and held it against my left breast, on top of my navy blue sweater. This, apparently, was all I needed to do. There were a few seconds when I thought he was pulling his hand away, which he was, but before my humiliation could be fully activated, he slid the hand back under my sweater and t-shirt, over my bra, and before long he'd slipped his thumb beneath the bra. Then he did kiss me. In spite of his handsomeness, I remained completely unaroused. My lack of arousal did not, however, prevent me from saying, after a minute or two, "Is there somewhere we can go?" He grabbed my hand and led me inside an unlocked door of the gym and through a corridor. Outside another door, this one maroon, he looked in either direction down the hall before pulling a key from his pocket. The room was windowless and contained soccer balls in vast net bags, bats, stacks of orange traffic cones, and other kinds of athletic equipment. There wasn't much open space on the polished concrete floor, but there was enough for a girl who was 5'4" to lie down, and for a boy who was a foot taller to lie on top of her. We used one of the condoms I'd just bought at the pharmacy. Had any condom purchased outside the heat of passion ever been used so efficiently? And the whole encounter lasted less than 10 minutes. Maybe closer to 5. None of it was physically enjoyable for me, except when he held my hand to lead me inside the gym. That had been the kind of thing I'd pictured a boyfriend doing. About 30 seconds after coming, as advertised, he did so with a whimper. He said, "I need to go to choir practice." And he rose up off me. We'd both kept our shirts on and hadn't entirely removed our pants. We refastened them, and I smoothed my hair. He opened the door carefully, looked into the hallway, then motioned for me to follow him. Outside the door, he locked it, glanced at me, smirked, and said, "See you around." Then he headed in one direction and, retracing our route in from the parking lot, I headed in the other. After college, I was a research assistant in a lab in Boston for 2 years before attending medical school at Johns Hopkins. I matched to my first choice residency, which was at the University of Iowa, and I was a year into it when I received a phone call from Isaac. I later learned that he had called information in Des Moines to get my parents' phone number, then asked my mother for my number. He was driving cross-country because he was about to start an English PhD program at Berkeley and wanted to know if I'd like to have dinner when he passed through Iowa City the following week. I was working 24-hour shifts, so we met instead for breakfast at a diner. From the minute I entered the restaurant and saw him sitting in the booth, when we made eye contact, he smiled, waved, and stood. I understood that Isaac was not gay. My heart thudded as we hugged, though I felt more excited than nervous. I was by then almost 30, and I'd had a few boyfriends and a few additional sexual partners, but I'd never before been able to tell for certain that someone else was as happy to be in my presence as I was to be in his. In medical school, I'd studied by re-listening to first and second year class lectures on tape, and I would speed up the lectures, making the professors sound like cartoon chipmunks, in order to get through them as fast as possible. In the diner, I wished I could increase the speed of my conversation with Isaac, not because I wanted to get it over with, but because I wanted both of us to cram in the maximum amount of words before I started my shift, because I felt we had such an enormous amount to say to each other. The great luck of my entire life is that 12 years have passed since Isaac and I had breakfast, and I still feel that way. We live outside Columbus, Ohio, where he is an English professor and I practice internal medicine at a clinic that serves uninsured immigrants. We have a daughter who is now 10 and a son who's 7. When we can, we like to go for family walks after dinner in our suburban neighborhood. Often our children dart ahead of us or discuss their own matters with each other, and when Isaac and I chat about our days or the news or movies we probably won't end up seeing, I am filled with gratitude at the astonishing fact of being married to someone I enjoy talking to, someone with whom I can't imagine ever running out of things to say. Isaac claims that he always had a crush on me, and that was the reason he hung out in Ray's room, even though he never much liked her. When I told Isaac that I'd believed he was gay, he was amused and asked why, and when I tried to pinpoint it, the best I could come up with was that he'd used gel in his hair, he'd buttoned the top button of his shirts, and I hadn't been uncomfortable around him. He was amused by all of this, too. It would be easy for me to be horrified by who I was more than 20 years ago. How ignorant. But I don't see what purpose it would serve. I'm relieved to have aged out of that visceral sense that my primary obligation is to be pretty. Relieved to work at a job that allows me to feel useful. Did I used to think being pretty was my primary obligation because I was in some way delusional? Or was it that I'd absorbed the messages I was meant to absorb with the same diligence with which I studied? As the mother of a daughter, I hope she won't judge herself as harshly as I judged myself. But her personality is so unlike mine. She is boisterous and outspoken, that I'm not inordinately concerned. Isaac, as I didn't know back in college, was also a virgin when I met him. It was in sophomore spring that he got together with his first girlfriend, which is to say he had sex after I did, but I trust, more thoroughly. Presumably, the campus of Dartmouth in the early 90s, like college campuses in every decade, like towns and cities everywhere, was home to many other virgins, average-looking girls and boys, and also grown-ups afraid that they were too ugly to be loved, convinced that this private shame was theirs alone. I had thought that extracting myself from my friendship with Ray would be tricky, that she'd resist, but it wasn't, and she didn't. That night at Exeter, I waited in the parking lot for more than an hour because I was amazed by the implications of my non-virgin status, and because I had Twizzlers to eat, I wasn't bored. And finally, the Honda Civic reappeared. When I climbed in, Ray expressed no contrition about abandoning me, and we listened many more times to the song Joking. I wondered if Noah would ever tell her what had happened, and if she'd confront or even physically accost me. But, of course, he had no more incentive to reveal anything than I did. I suspect that they weren't in touch much longer. All sophomores at Dartmouth stayed on campus and took classes for the summer, and it was at some point in July or August that I realized it had been a long while since I'd laid eyes on Ray, even from a distance. The only conversation I remember having with Isaac at Dartmouth after my trip to Manchester was when I ran into him that summer outside Bakerberry Library, and he confirmed that Ray had dropped out. These days, Isaac and I almost never talk about Ray, though she crosses my mind with regularity. I'm far more troubled that she probably didn't earn a degree from Dartmouth than that I had sex with her boyfriend. I found no trace of her online, and in this void, I've created a biography. She works in public relations for a large and mildly nefarious corporation. She's tough and powerful and makes a lot of money. She never wanted children and lives in a swanky apartment in a big city with her good-looking and, I can't resist, slightly younger boyfriend. If you were to mention Isaac or me, she wouldn't know who we were, but upon consideration, she'd acknowledge that our names sounded vaguely familiar. bad latch. Of the 10 of us enrolled in the prenatal yoga class that summer at the Y, I was the second most pregnant, and the woman who was the most pregnant was named Gretchen. All of us sat on oversized rubber balls, and Gretchen always staked out the center of the front row, closest to the instructor. The first class, when we were supposed to go around and say our name, due date, whether we knew if it was a boy or girl, and where we were planning to deliver, she said August 18th. My due date was August 29th, and added, "Carl and I want to be surprised about the gender, because in our information-saturated world, it's nice to still allow for some mystery and magic, right?" She'd turned around on her ball so she was facing those of us in the second and third rows, and she smiled self-congratulatorily. She had a high brown ponytail and wore a mint-green tank top that stretched over her belly and cost $62, which I knew because I'd seen it at a maternity boutique full of clothes I couldn't afford. "We're delivering at home with a midwife," Gretchen continued, "drug-free and all that. And then I'll be a stay-at-home mom because it's like, if you're going to outsource your child care, why even bother to become a parent in the first place?" Lest it seem like this class occurred in a place where you could get away with saying such things, Brooklyn, maybe, or Berkeley, it didn't. It occurred in Omaha, Nebraska, and I heard Gretchen repeat her comments verbatim, "Carl, information-saturated, mystery, magic, home birth, drug-free, outsource," every Saturday morning for the next 5 weeks because the instructor liked us to reintroduce ourselves each time. The sixth class, Gretchen wasn't there. Her absence meant that when we discussed which parts of our bodies were newly sore or swollen, a discussion Gretchen had consistently dominated, my concerns took precedence over everyone else's. At the end of class, as we lay under nubbly Mexican blankets while the instructor guided us on a visualization of our peaceful, joyous deliveries, I wondered how Gretchen's home birth had gone. Or perhaps she was in labor at that very moment, simultaneously snacking on organic trail mix and breathing mindfully as stalwart Carl massaged her hips. As for me, at the grocery store, strangers would look at my belly and say, "Any minute now!" Then, at 5 a.m. on a hot Thursday, after a bunch of contractions, an epidural, a lot of pushing, and a lot more pushing, she arrived. We had known in advance she'd be a girl, and we'd decided to call her Sadie. Everything about her was otherworldly and astonishing. Her eyes were big and brown, her nose was tiny and upturned, and her mouth was set in a nonplussed purse. "She looks mad," I said, and my husband, Adam, who was choked up, said, "We have a daughter." It was a month later that I saw Gretchen again, this time at the weekly breastfeeding support group hosted by the maternity boutique whose clothes I couldn't afford. By then, Sadie was sleeping at night in a carpeted cat box between Adam and me, and we'd removed everything but the fitted sheet from our bed, all in an effort to get some rest while not smothering her. Also, I was finding nursing unbearable. The moment of her clamping on was like someone biting your skinned knee, and whenever she turned her head toward my chest, rooting, I was filled with dread. Intermittently, I'd place huge green cabbage leaves on my boobs, between my bra and skin, a recommendation I'd read on a website, though I'd yet to experience any decrease in soreness. Adam had returned to his office a week after Sadie's birth. I, meanwhile, would have a 3-month maternity leave before resuming my job 4 days a week, one of which I'd work from home. On the days I couldn't be with Sadie, Adam's mother would come to our house to babysit. Although my job was considerably less cool than what I'd once imagined doing with my life, my employer was a multinational food manufacturer that, as it happened, was the number one seller of infant formula, which I wasn't planning to use. My flexible childcare arrangement made me feel as if 7 years with the company and a good relationship with my boss were paying.